John, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I was actually watching a lot of the shorts last night. I'm excited.
You saw his trivia skills broken out a little bit?
A little bit different than what we're talking about today, but yeah.
It's good.
So, John, first of all, could you introduce yourself before we get into questions about your trips to Gaza and what you've seen there?
Sure. So I'm John Spencer. I'm the chair of urban warfare studies at the Modern War Institute, which is a research center at the United States Military Academy at West Point. I served 25 years as a soldier myself, had two combat deployments into Iraq, both at the beginning and at the end of the operations in Iraq. And then I was teaching strategy at West Point, stood up a research center, which is the Modern War Institute. And I started researching only urban combat, which is a very unique set of war and warfare. And for over a decade, I've been researching, writing, traveling into war zones, studying just urban warfare.
You've been to Gaza two times now. How did you get in there? And let's start from there and open it up.
Sure. Well, because I study urban warfare, I've been going in and out of Israel as well over the last 5 or 6 years. So I've made a lot of contacts with the IDF and people in Israel. So because of my contacts, because of my writing, when the war started, I went there and started asking questions to the IDF and friends and got meetings, and then led to both walking the ground of October 7th and going in to Gaza, especially in December, where I went into the big Hamas tunnel that they found near the border of Israel and Gaza. I came back and I started writing a lot about what I was seeing in the war, so that my second trip, when I went back to Israel in February, because of my writings, I got an invitation to talk with the Prime Minister of Israel, the head of the IDF, the Chief General, and made a connection with the division commander who was leading the fight in Khan Yunis, who said, you know, I'll take you in. And I rode with him with the IDF into Khan Yunis, where they just concluded the operation, where one of the biggest battles at that moment was happening.
Can you describe the scene on the ground there in Khan Yunis when you were there?
So some of these things are so hard to put, but you could say surreal, but I've been studying urban combat for a long time. I've had my own urban combat experiences. I've never seen anything as in the density of the urban terrain, the tunnels riddled underneath the ground of the soldiers, and the rubble that was the fight. Each time I've gone, I've learned something, because I don't consider myself an expert in much. Definitely a student of war and a student of urban combat. I mean, I saw a lot during that time walking around with the division commander, the different types of units, the understanding the different threats, how even in Khan Yunis, the Hamas fighters don't wear uniforms, but I saw how they had set up caches in one building, would drop their weapons in that building, walk out in civilians, walk to the next building, and the complexity of what that took for the IDF to basically move forward and clear that urban terrain, because that's the ultimate goal. And I saw a lot of uniquenesses in how because of the pressures the IDF have been under, have deployed new things that never been done in war, like surrounding a area and then asking everybody to evacuate that area through a single checkpoint and using facial recognition. So basically capturing Hamas without actually firing a shot. I saw a lot while I was there. I don't know if there's any specific questions on what I saw, but I mean, I've been studying it since October 7th.
There are so many questions we want to get into. One broad one is, what is the death toll that you go by?
So, there is no number that I go by, because I've actually, from studying all urban combat in general, I know that you can't have a number in the middle of the war on a day-to-day basis, especially down to the single digit. I mean, the biggest battle since World War II was the Battle of Mosul against ISIS in 2016 to 17. And a year after the battle, the Iraqi government still did not know how many civilians had died in that battle. It ranged from as low as 9,000 to as high as 40,000. And basically the greater United Nations and everybody else and the Iraqis settled on 11,000 died in that battle. In this battle, in this war, which is actually a big difference too, is that people compare the numbers of from a battle to a war. There have been multiple battles in this war against Hamas. Even if I use the Hamas numbers of 32 to 33,000 total killed, because the Gaza Health Ministry doesn't distinguish between Hamas combatant and civilians. And actually, as we're talking just last week, the Gaza Health Ministry said that they couldn't account for 11,000 of those 32,000 killed because of the way they track is unique. Like, I've never studied a war where you have a civilian count in the moment. It's just because of, if you just think about the complexity of getting civilians out of harm's way, evacuating hundreds of thousands, the actual rubble and the fighting going on, how would you possibly have a number on a day-to-day basis? But I have been able to write about the numbers, even if we used the Gaza Health Ministry numbers of 33,000 compared against what the IDF says. If I just use everybody's numbers, it doesn't paint the same narrative that the world has tried to use to understand what's going on, which is really hard to do.
So can you describe just kind of in broad terms Hamas's military strategy and Israel's military strategy?
Sure. I think that's a great question. So if we take Hamas's military strategy based on what they say from October 7th was first on October 7th was to kill as many Jewish people and get as far north as they could on that. What you would basically say the opening of the war was on October 7th by Hamas invading southern Israel, killing over 1,000 people, and people debate on who they were, and I've walked the ground. But they also wanted to get as far north as they could. They wanted Hezbollah to join the fight. They wanted members of different organizations within the West Bank to join the fight. They wanted a lot. So overall, and that was the first step of their strategy. Once the Israel responded and declared war against Hamas, in basically, if you want to make that the start of the war, the Hamas strategy has been, according to them, to get as many of their people killed as possible to pursue a political objective, because all war is the pursuit of policy objectives, political objectives, right? It's actually in a war. From the Hamas side, their policy objective is to survive the war, period. Because they have an ultimate grand strategy. But in the strategy for the war is Hamas took over 200 hostages and they started launching rockets at Israel. There were 4,000 rockets launched in the first few hours. There have been 12,000 launched by Hamas at Israel since the war began. And about 10% of those have landed inside of Gaza. But their objective is just to survive the war, but also to use the death of their people, the Palestinian people of Gaza, to force this, because all war is also a contest of will, to force this, what has happened, which is the international condemnation, the narrative of what Israel is doing, to force Israel to stop, like has happened in Israel's previous war, because Hamas has studied Israel just as much as anybody else has, and knows the sensitivities and the political aspects to war. So Hamas strategy, bar none, has been to survive the war and become giants in the world of terrorism and to cause the international community, namely the United States, to force Israel to stop no matter what Israel does and just pursue some other objective. That would be the Hamas strategy.
Hey, John, before we go into Israel's strategy, could you quickly talk about the Hamas chain of command? We understand their leadership based outside of Gaza, but what does that look like?
Sure. So Hamas is a government, firstly. It has a military. Hamas's chain of command includes its political wing, which is the top three leaders, which are all billionaires, and are billionaires based on the aid that was sent to Gaza. But three billionaires who sit in Qatar are basically make up the political wing. The military wing, which resides in Gaza, headed by Yahya Sinwar. It's made up of a few leaders, him and his brother, and that's the chain of command, which goes down to the military, actual military. It's the military wing in, but also is the government of Gaza. The military wing, which includes 30 to 40,000, you know, basically card-carrying Hamas military members broken up into brigades and battalions. So the chain of command of military. In each one of the battalions, so there are 30 battalions roughly before on October 7th, who all had different areas of control. Like if you think Gaza City, Beit Hanun, Khan Yunis, Rafah, those were all assigned to brigade and battalion commanders. So they were set up in a very structured chain of command. But you're right, the military wing, which resides in Gaza, and then you have the kind of the political leadership, which resides in Qatar.
So yeah, super helpful. Now, so what is Israel's strategy in the Gaza war?
So let me finish off on the Hamas strategy, just the fact that the use of human shields, which is not new in any war, and Hamas, I teach a class on urban warfare to division levels, is the textbook of human shield use, as in using human, you know, non-combatants as a shield against the use of force against you. But Hamas, unique, even ISIS didn't, deploys a strategy of human sacrifice, where they literally have stated their leadership in their words, they need as many of their people to die to pursue their political objectives, to martyr. They want all of their people, which is actually unique. I mean, ISIS used human shields, but they weren't trying to get as many of people as they say of their people killed. They were really using shields of people, you know, in a different way. Okay, Israel's strategy at the start of the war on October 7th, and they declared war against Hamas in Gaza, was to bring the hostages home, so over to 200 plus hostages that were taken on October 7th, to destroy Hamas as a military organization. We just talked about their chain of command, to destroy them as a military organization with military capability, right? Those 30 battalions, those 12 to 20,000 rockets, their ability to produce rockets, their tunnel infrastructure, which we didn't talk about yet, but the 400 plus miles of tunnels underneath Gaza, and to secure Israel's borders. So that's the border between Gaza and Israel. Those are the three objectives of Israel. Their strategy to do that has been to deploy, much like everybody else, to deploy a joint, you know, cyber, air, sea, ground forces to move forward and destroy, which has a definition, destroy the Hamas military, but also to execute operations in order to retrieve the hostages. In order to achieve Israel's goal, the strategy, which is debatable, has been to launch this ground invasion and methodically clear urban terrain to search it, to kill or capture the Hamas military members, and then to retrieve the hostages in any way, to include with the temporary ceasefire, which brought roughly half of the hostages home. That's been the strategy moving forward for Israel.
So now I think it's Secretary Blinken who's called for these kind of like targeted raids to go in and take people out, kind of like what has been suggested we do in Afghanistan or with against other terrorist groups. But obviously a lot of other people think that's not at all possible given the scale of Hamas and what's involved in the war here. Can you share some of your thoughts on that question? Are raids the answer?
Sure.
Is the ground war correct?
Sure. And I wrote that in a Wall Street Journal article directly at Secretary Blinken's recommendations, which have been more vocal recently, but actually started on October 8th, there were senior U.S. personnel who were advising Israel could accomplish their three goals without a ground invasion, and to use what I call the Zero Dark 30 fallacy, which is that you can achieve your strategy goals through the use of small unit strategic raids and surgical strikes. It's a fallacy because it's a technique used against terrorism. While Hamas is a terrorist organization designated by the United States, the United Kingdom, and many other countries, it's also a de facto state. It is an organization which controls all forms of power in a autonomous area that they control with a giant military. So I think that the ideal that you could achieve the goal of Israel's strategy that everybody recognized was a just war and legitimate goals, but that you could achieve that goal using just raids and surgical strikes. That's never been done in the history of military operations, right? If you think about the taking out of the Taliban in 2001, the taking out of the Saddam regime in 2003, the taking out of the Panama terrorist regime. If you really go through the history, you first have to destroy the enemy, and then you can go into these counterterrorism, counterinsurgency strategies, which are very important and a lot of hard-learned lessons just from the U.S. military over the last 20 years. But that's a misapplication, apples to oranges, to what we just talked about, which is the military chain of command and structure of Hamas in Gaza. That would never have led to success, in my strong opinion, based on history. And I'd argue it with anybody. I've actually argued with secretaries of defenses recently who are misapplying lessons of counterinsurgency and counterterrorism to a war against a ruling power with a vast military. It just, you know, that dog don't hunt, as we say.
Let's talk about the tunnels in Gaza for a second. So could you describe the tunnel infrastructure, how they built them, what they're used for, and have you been in the tunnels?
So yes, I've been in the tunnels in many spots. It's really hard to describe the tunnels because they're so vast. I mean, they're before the war, and I was a underground warfare student, lots of conferences and studies. I've been in Hezbollah tunnels in northern Israel. I've been in Hamas tunnels in southern. I've been in North Korean tunnels in South Korea. The tunnels in Gaza are very unique for many reasons. One, how vast they are. So we thought they were around 300 miles before the war, but based on the clearing operations and the discovery of tunnels, the Hamas tunnels in Gaza are around 400 miles of tunnels, which is really hard to do in a space that's only, you know, 25 miles wide or long and 7 miles wide at the biggest point, you know, 200 square kilometers. It's really hard to figure out how to dig 400 miles of tunnels under that small of terrain, but they did it. And the tunnels range from 15 feet underground to 200 or 300 feet underground. And at the range of about 200 feet, there's not much military munitions that can reach that. But also unique to these tunnels that they range from, you know, tunnels used to both for offense and defense. So, you know, tunnels that you would use to pop up and surprise somebody that's, you know, in an area, or defensively just to shield yourself from bombings and from aerial observation. But the Hamas tunnels, unique again to Gaza, is that the Hamas tunnels were dug only under civilian sites. So I used to say that they were uniquely dug underneath civilian buildings, hospitals, schools, UN facilities, but from visiting and going into them, sometimes the tunnels were actually dug and then a school put on top of them. But if you compare the tunnels to any other kind of environment, right? So this goes again where history should be a guide. I mean, there are massive tunnels in China and in North Korea, but they're not, and they're hundreds of miles as well and very deep, what we call military grade depth. They're not only dug under civilian sites for the exact reason of using those civilian sites as protection under the laws of war. How they're dug, Max, what is actually a great question. Most of the tunnels in Gaza were dug with human labor, whether it was forced labor or voluntary labor, because of the sediment, which is very unique in southern, you know, Gaza, or in Gaza in general, and southern Israel, is very, you know, sandy. So you can actually use like DeWalt power tools, and you can dig very, you know, not very fast, but very quickly. In comparison, like the Hezbollah tunnels that I've been in northern Israel, that are dug through diamond tip drills, drilling straight into rock. So in southern Israel and in Gaza, the sediment is very loose, so you can hand dig it or dig it with you know, small power tools. But the tunnel that I was in December, which was it's 100 meters outside of the Israel-Gaza border wall, 400 meters from the crossing point, but it was 100 meters. It was a massive tunnel that you could drive cars through, trucks through. It was an invasion tunnel with It was a 2.5 miles long. It really reminded me of the North Korean invasion tunnel that I was in a long time ago that sits along the North Korean and South Korean border. That was meant to be an invasion tunnel where you could flow thousands of troops into a country that you're invading very rapidly over minutes. And that's what I saw in the tunnel that I was in December. But the tunnels range from, you know, ones that are just literally you can only walk one person through at a time, but they're advanced because you know, in order to go underground, you got to have ventilation. You got to have power. Some of these have communication. Some of these are like luxury tunnels. They found Yahya Sinwar's, some of his luxury tunnels that are, you know, all painted. They have ceiling fans, air conditioners, TVs. The range is really very wide, but it's expansive. And I don't think people understand the complexity of it, plus the challenge of it. I mean, this is the idea of like, why are you bombing northern Gaza so much? So I've gotten this, right? I've gotten the misapplication of comparing bombings of other wars to the war, especially in the beginning of the war, because of what it takes to reach underground. You know, a normal like artillery round won't penetrate the ground. And we have bunker busting munitions that are designed just for tunnels, but even they have limits. So this is like, there's been one report about, you know, more 2,000 pound bombs dropped than any other war in the last, since World War II. Like, okay, that's a true statement, because nobody in the last 50 years has faced a combatant who is underground like that, where you would need deep penetrating 2,000 pound bombs to reach them.
What about the use of dumb bombs, which is a common criticism of Israel's conduct in the war?
Yeah, it's a misapplication again of types of wars. The dumb bomb, you know, the fact that, you know, New York Times and other people ran with, you know, the fact that Israel has used about 50% what they put, I'm putting in quotation marks, dumb bombs versus precision guided munitions. So really, you know, post the 1990s, precision guided munitions, which are munitions which have technologies on the front of them, which can guide them in flight and other things to an exact location, as in within 1 to 50 meters, where anything that doesn't have that precision guided technology on it is considered a dumb munition. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't hit where they're aiming at, which is really the law of war, you know, kind of discrimination. You have to be hitting a military target. You have to be aiming at a military target. When somebody takes, okay, those are all the precision guided munitions, the other munitions that you're dropping, which still can be highly accurate on how you drop them, and that you can say, like, I am legitimately aiming at a military target. The problem is when somebody who doesn't know says dumb bomb means just firing it and where it hits is where it hits. No. The difference is what they call the circular probability of error. Like how far off will that round hit without that precision guiding technology on it? It could be 5 meters. It could be 50 meters. And like an artillery round, for instance. And we dropped, you know, 35,000 artillery rounds in a single month in the Battle of Raqqa. Every one of those would be considered a dumb bomb or a dumb munition because it doesn't have precision guided munitions. So that's the criticism is, again, people are comparing other battles against a war and then trying to use any comparison in this war that would make Israel look like it's doing something indiscriminately, like carpet bombing, which we used to do. We decided after World War II that is not okay to just carpet bomb, as in just line up airplanes above a city and just drop bombs, and where they hit is where they hit. You think the Blitz of London, and you think those type of wars. We don't do that anymore. But that inference of, well, Israel has dropped, you know, 50% dumb bombs. Like, okay, Israel doesn't have an unlimited amount of precision-guided munitions. And those who have tried to implement wars with only precision-guided munitions, like we did in the Battle of Mosul, we ran out of precision-guided munitions because the enemy actually drove the use of certain bombs, certain missiles, and we ran out of our like Hellfire missiles, which is a, you know, a helicopter usually or a drone delivered munition, which has a precision guided technology on it.
Another criticism though has been the killing of a lot of aid workers and journalists. I mean, there's lots of statistics out there that, you know, to that effect. Have yeah, how do you look into that? How do you respond to that?
Sure. Well, I start with, you know, I do only unclassed like everybody else who uses these statistics. I do unclassed research, right? I don't have access to secret or other types of information, but the United States says that there has been zero evidence, which has a very specific meaning, of Israel targeting any journalist, media, aid worker, or civilians, period. They've actually said that within the last month. There's been zero evidence. Now, is there civilian casualties? Of course there are. Have there been media and journalists killed? Of course there has been, who have been in harm's way. And have there been humanitarian aid workers who have been killed? Absolutely, by accident, not being targeted. Now, when you say more than, right? So this is the whole, all these conversations, more journalists killed than, since whatever. Okay. Usually they're talking about the last 20 or 30 years. Usually they're talking about, you know, or they'll try to take a single battle, an urban battle, because that's what we're talking about, urban battles. And they'll compare like the Battle of Mosul, Raqqa, Aleppo, you know, again, all out of actual apples to oranges. But the real question is Israel, has Israel targeted journalists, aid workers, civilians? And the answer is no. By all those who have access to the information and to those who actually study it like me, the answer is no, they're not purposely targeting. Now, have there been people who have been in, had there been mistakes that Israel has made? Absolutely. Have there been journalists, civilians, other those who have been in harm's way despite all the efforts? Yes. The answer is yes.
So as you said earlier, there's no way of knowing an exact to the person casualty count, both for fighters and also civilians. But let's generally take, let's say, a midpoint of Israel's numbers and the Palestinian Health Ministry's numbers. So that would put us at about 8,000 Hamas fighter casualties and 25,000 civil, or about 25,000 total. So let's say 3-to-1 civilian to fighter casualty ratio. How does that compare to other wars, especially modern wars? And what does the Israel government do to minimize civilian casualties? Is that something they go out of their way to do? Because I think a lot of people see the devastating images and videos and go, this seems indiscriminate.
So yeah, that's a great question. And for some, it has been a focus of all everybody's attention is those numbers, right? If we had a number, would it be 3-to-1? Would it be 2-to-1? And then what can we compare that against? And you said modern wars. This is where I've strongly, and I wrote this in an article to help people understand, there is no comparison in modern history. You have to go back to actual wars of like World War II. And I could show you in battles that the United States were a part of, because we usually like to compare, when we say modern wars, we're talking about modern wars in which we want to believe, or we know that the actual attacker is following the laws of war, right? So we want to take off the Syrian war. We want to take off Russia's wars in Chechnya. We want to take off any wars in, you know, in the African continent. We want to take off wars where, okay, we can't use those numbers because we recognize that they weren't following the laws of war, trying to prevent civilian harm. If you take any war in which the U.S. or an ally who actually follows the laws of war, those numbers are incredibly low, as in, given the context of the enemy, the size of the enemy, so 30 to 40,000 Hamas miners in tunnels underneath their cities in this densely populated urban areas, right? And this is where, you know, people have, like the Battle of Mosul, which was the biggest battle, which is, Max, really think about it, the biggest battle since World War II was the Battle of Mosul in 2016. So 4,000 ISIS fighters holding a city of, you know, a million plus, depending on, again, how you do your numbers. And then that ratio, there is a 4,000 ISIS fighters, 10,000 civilians killed. I've just never seen any war where that has been the leading determination of whether the actual attacker is trying to prevent civilian harm. So that gets into, okay, if you believe to me and that the numbers of actually civilian to combatant is historically low for any war post-World War II, because even if I go to the Battle of Manila, U.S. military killed 100,000 civilians. The Battle of Seoul, which is post-Geneva Conventions, there is no record of how many civilians died, but it's in the tens of thousands. In that battle, these are ones that we took part of. What has Israel done to prevent civilian casualties, right? So even if we had numbers, for the first thing they did was not launch the invasion. So after October 7th, they could have immediately responded with an overwhelming force, and they didn't. They waited 3 weeks from declaring the war to actually doing the civilian evacuations. So at the beginning of, actually at the end of October, they started evacuations. And that historically has been the number one thing that militaries do if they follow the laws of war to prevent civilian casualties, is wait to evacuate the cities, give time, make a safe route, and tell the civilians where to go. Although, again, Gaza is very unique. I will give credit to that, to any war in really in history where the civilians don't have a place to go because Egypt refused to let them go into Egypt. No evacuations could go into Egypt to get out of the actual different combat areas. So they set one up near the Egypt-Gaza border. So that's very unique. So the first thing they did was evacuate the cities, and they used all the standard techniques, dropping flyers. And we did this in all the recent urban battles of like Mosul and other places. But they also started, because Israel's unique, started calling everybody in the environment, sending text messages, sending drones with loudspeakers on them, just trying to find civilians and then telling them to evacuate and telling them where to go. That's the first thing they did in the opening phase, which is really the only phase anybody wants to talk about, as Israel actually reduced its combat operations, as it started more clearing operations. And by the time it got to central Gaza, which nobody gives credit to, the actual civilian to combatant ratio was so low that they weren't tracking it anymore. So by January of this war, the number of actual civilians dying was so low that nobody was doing the comparison then, because it didn't paint the right picture. And by the time I visited in February in Khan Yunis, I mean, the restrictions that the IDF put on themselves was that they would not go into areas if there was any type of civilian population into them. And this has been the, you know, this evolution too, that Israel started handing out their maps in December. The military maps that no military has done in the history of war, to include my military and my own operations in the U.S. military, where we make these maps in urban areas where you number every building, you number neighborhoods, and you make a map so you can understand where you are, where the enemy is. Well, Israel gave those maps out to the civilians and to the combatants, and told the combatants where they would be every day. So they told the civilians, hey, in this area, there will be an operation tomorrow. You need to be out of it, which also told the enemy that's where the IDF would be. They were also doing daily pauses, which is also unique to urban battles. Starting in October, in November, when the operation started, they were calling daily pauses of the battle, of the war, for like 4 hours. Sometimes they would do it at random times, but they have a list, and you can look it up in the IDF, but like every day that they called a pause and said, okay, for these hours, the IDF will not conduct combat operations so that civilians can evacuate along this route to this area in the pursuit of civilian harm. And this is where I've said, and I've written this, not based on John Spencer's opinion, but based on the facts of any urban battle, Israel has done more, as in actually actions, not interpretation of what the destruction you see. They have done more to prevent civilian harm, as in more steps, more action, than any other military in the history of war in this war, which is actually pretty unique. The only thing they could do more is not conduct the operation, period.
John, I wish we had another couple hours to dig much deeper into all this, but we're just about out of time. One last question that I have for you before is, the situation between Israel and Iran right now is extremely tense. There's still this question of whether Israel will retaliate on the Iranian strike on Israel last weekend. If this were to spiral, if this were to escalate, do you have any sense of what that conflict would look like if we had a direct war between Israel and Iran?
You said we. So it's if Israel is in a battle against Iran, This is the, again, people that try to predict wars, which is, I taught war, you know, at the academy level. It's really hard to predict, because when nations go to war like that, when you have actually state on state war like that, it can spiral, as in who else is involved in that war. And this is what we saw in the defense of Israel. We saw people defending Israel that, of course, the United States assisted in defending Israel when Iran attacked with a historic level of munitions. I mean, more than the U.S. military, by comparison and by hours and all that, did in our wars. But how it could spiral is who else is involved, because that's a level of escalation that nobody wants to see. In my personal opinion, though, people discount deterrence, right? Deterrence is like this giant theory of how do you prevent wars? It's through deterrence, through there's many forms of it. When Israel took out the leader of the IGRC guy, the terrorist that they took out in Damascus, and then Iran escalated and struck Israel with this massive, they escalated and basically said deterrence had failed. So the U.S. said don't do it, Israel said don't do it, and Iran, for their reasons, did it. I don't think Israel cannot respond. It's just a matter of how and when. But nobody wants to see a state-on-state war in the Middle East because of history of how that can spiral to, okay, who's on, who is all involved on both sides. And if you look at the Iran-Iraq war and the millions of people that died in that war, nobody wants to see that.
John, I actually want to squeeze another question in, which is, you've seen all the fighting and you've seen Gaza from the IDF perspective. And I know you're not in the IDF. You're an American veteran. You're an expert in urban warfare. Have you done anything or been able to talk to Gazans or done anything to get the other side of the war and somehow, do everything you can to see how maybe a Gazan family that is young, that did not elect Hamas or was super young for that, not eligible to vote, kind of has seen the war?
So I have not been able to access the other side. I do war studies, so my access would be to try to get to the Hamas military side to understand that. I'm trying to understand the tactics and how it's executed. But I will say, I've watched the same footage that everybody else does, and I 100% agree that this is not a war against the Palestinian people of Gaza, and that their lives, this is from, as a student of war, the greatest chance of their lives improving is through the destruction of Hamas, who executed October 7th, who siphoned billions of dollars that could have turned Gaza into a vast, amazing, Singapore in the Middle East. And that's why you have three billionaires and all that. I actually do feel for them. And I of course, I've seen a lot of bad things in war, studying wars, and I absolutely feel for the Palestinian people. But I also strongly believe that the greatest path to their improving their lives, so from their quality of life to education to every element, is through removing Hamas as the governing power of them, like you said, who didn't really elect them.
John, thank you so much for coming. When do you return to Gaza?
June. I'll be back in June. Yep.
Well, this was utterly fascinating. Thank you for your time, and we hope to talk to you again in the future.
Thank you.